Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the internet, freedom of speech, and international relations. Can foreign governments have an impact on online speech here in the United States? Also, the Trump administration wants to make changes to a federal college loan program. We'll examine the potential impacts. And the state's great white shark expert on what we're learning from the sharks off Cape Cod.
So the sharks seem to have an offshore phase where they wander out into the middle of these oceans. And here in the North Atlantic, when they wander out there, they started doing amazing things.
Plus, a long walk along the Cape's changing shore with writer Robert Finch.
I always compare it to falling in love with someone. You have this passion to know them. You want to find out every possible thing about them that you can. At the same time, you hope you never will, that sense of mystery will remain.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. More changes are coming to the MBTA. General Manager Brian Shortsleeve will be stepping down next month, meaning the Transit Authority will be getting its third general manager in 2 years. Here's the announcement from Governor Charlie Baker.
The MBTA is still in turnaround mode and needs a turnaround CEO, not a traditional manager.
Joining us now with more is WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown. Hi there, Steve.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, tell us, Brian Shortsleeve stepping down, why is that?
Well, when he was hired 2 years ago, he said he would give them 2 years The 2 years ends at the end of June, so he is going to be stepping down, although he's still going to be involved with the T. He's going to be moving over to the Financial and Management Control Board, which oversees the finances of the T.
Okay, so a man true to his word then, keeping his promise about being at the head of the T only for a couple of years. Did Governor Charlie Baker then make an announcement about who would be replacing or who will be replacing Shortsleeve?
Well, yes, Steve Poftak, who is the on the Management and Control Board, will be filling in on an interim basis. And then once they finally hire a new permanent general manager, Poftak will go back to the Management and Control Board. They're basically keeping a seat open for him once he gets done with being the interim GM.
Now, we heard a little bit earlier that cut from the governor saying he's looking for a turnaround CEO for the MBTA, not a traditional manager. Here's a little bit more of what the governor said about the kind of candidate he's going to be looking for.
And we expect this candidate will have a strong business background and experience in industries that provide direct service to customers and deliver large-scale capital projects.
Okay, so again, a turnaround CEO with business experience, that seems to be where Governor Baker's mind is for the future MBTA GM. Steve Brown, I mean, describe to us some of the challenges that GM is probably going to face.
Well, there's still more fixing of the T that needs to be done. Brian Shortsleeve got the ball rolling, and the Baker administration gives him a lot of credit for righting the ship over there at the MBTA. Don't forget, it was just a little over 2 years ago we were having those massive snowstorms that really brought to light the problems at the MBTA, and that's what forced the governor and the legislature to create the Fiscal Control Board and put an administrator like Brian Shortsleeve in place. They're going to be looking for the next thing. We've got over that initial thing. They've made some of those important fixes. I ride the Red Line. I've seen some of the fixes they've made along there. It runs pretty well. Granted, we haven't had any snowstorms like we did back
right.
In January and February of 2015. That will be the real test. I'm sure we're going to be getting some of those storms maybe this winter or winter down the road. So we'll see how things made out over at the T once those things happen.
Well, that's Steve Brown. He's WBUR's State House reporter. Steve, thanks so very much.
Thanks, Meghna.
All right, well, now on to education news. The Trump administration says it wants to simplify the federal college loan program so that it becomes a single repayment system based on a person's income. But as WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin reports, the proposal would end a popular incentive for students who choose lower-paying jobs in public service.
Until a few weeks ago, Griselda Tomeno was a social worker. Her job was helping families find therapy and support for kids with mental illness.
ADHD, adjustment disorder, PTSD, depression, anxiety. We also work with kids with autism.
She had to juggle 9 or 10 complicated cases on any given week. And since she speaks Spanish and Portuguese, she had extra work in translating. In that job, she earned $37,000 a year, just about half the median household income in Massachusetts. And she has a mountain of college debt. She borrowed about $60,000 to get her bachelor's degree at Boston University. Now she hopes to get licensed as a social worker, so she'll need a master's degree. Tomeno will pursue hers at Smith College starting in the fall. That means more loans, bringing her up to around $100,000 in total debt. But she has cause for hope in something called Public Service Loan Forgiveness. It's a federal program that pays off the student debt of people after 10 years working in the public interest, in government or for nonprofits. For Tomeno, that would make a world of difference.
Me being able to buy a car, saving money up for a house, it would mean a lot.
Tomeno registered for the program last year, which means she has 9 more years of work to go. But would she have chosen a different route if this program didn't exist?
No. This is the profession where my strengths lie and where I truly feel intelligent and like I'm making an impact on the world, and I wouldn't trade that in.
Nationwide, 550,000 students have signed up in anticipation of that same public service benefit. The first wave of them will see their debt wiped out later this year. But President Trump is proposing an end to the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. Instead, he would ask all undergraduates with federal loans to pay 12.5% of their income for the first 15 years after graduation. The rest would be forgiven. That's a slight rejiggering of the Loan Forgiveness Program set up during the Obama administration. In addition to ending the forgiveness program, Trump also wants to stop federal subsidies that cover loan interest while a student is still in school. The changes are supposed to simplify a labyrinthine loan system that's built up over decades. Pauline Abernathy, who heads up policy at the Institute of College Access and Success, says the proposal would do more harm than good.
These changes together would dramatically increase borrowing costs, and there's no reason that simplification needs to do that.
The Institute estimates that ending federal subsidies could raise the price of loans by 15 to 25%. Which could mean thousands of dollars more per student. The policy group says that teachers who seek master's degrees could end up paying 3 times as much as they do right now. The Trump budget says it would end loan forgiveness for graduates pursuing public service careers because it unfairly favors some career choices over others. Economist Jason Delisle supports the move, saying that cases like Tomeno show that the program has created a perverse incentive for schools to overcharge and for students to overborrow.
This student can show up and say, I don't need to worry about how much this program costs. I'm not paying for it. That's crazy. And we've let the school off the hook.
Delisle is concerned about a coming bonanza when hundreds of thousands of students with lots of debt, including doctors and lawyers in nonprofit jobs, will pass the remainder on to taxpayers. But Pauline Abernathy says that misses the point of the public service plan, which was to draw students to choose service careers and lower incomes.
Particularly in rural areas and certain communities where there's a shortage of professionals, public service loan forgiveness is really essential for helping to attract people to those professions.
For her part, Griselda Tomeno is watching the policy discussion with some concern. But she doesn't have to worry, at least about her undergraduate debt. Officials at the Department of Education said this week that loans borrowed before summer 2018 would be grandfathered in to the forgiveness plan. How will she get by if the benefit does change while she's studying for her master's degree?
I'm pretty resourceful. So, like, I feel like if I ever get to the point where, like, I need to do any sort of combination of things to make it work, I'll just make it work.
For now, that means Tameno has set up a GoFundMe page to ask for donations toward her tuition, and that she's hoping for the best from Washington.
That story from WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin. Well, this is graduation season, as you know, and we've been playing excerpts of some of the many commencement speeches given around the state this month. In addition, WBUR's been examining John F. Kennedy's legacy all this week, so today we're going to combine the two and step back in time a little bit to 1963 and a speech Kennedy made at Amherst College at the groundbreaking of the Robert Frost Library there. WBUR's Kelly Horan reports on Kennedy's remarks about the arts in the life of a great nation and the importance of Frost in particular.
Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
Kennedy rejected Ted Sorensen's speech for the occasion as thin and stale. He wrote a new one en route to the event on Air Force One with Arthur Schlesinger. Privilege is here, Kennedy tells his audience, and with privilege goes responsibility. It's a familiar refrain from a president known for his call to service. But Kennedy's remarks this day are more personal. He has come to pay tribute to a friend.
For Robert Frost was one of the granite figures of our time in America. He was supremely two things, an artist and an American. A nation reveals itself not only by the men it produces, but also by the men it honors, the men it remembers.
Robert Frost composed a poem for Kennedy's inauguration that predicted that Kennedy's would be, as he wrote, a golden age of poetry and power.
And it's hardly an accident that Robert Frost coupled poetry and power. For he saw poetry as the means of saving power from itself. When power leads man towards arrogance, poetry reminds him of his limitations. When power narrows the areas of man's concern, poetry reminds him of the richness and diversity of his existence. When power corrupts, poetry cleanses.
But the poet also questioned power. When Frost returned from meeting Nikita Khrushchev in the summer of 1962, he told reporters that the Soviet leader had told him that Americans were, as he put it, too liberal to fight. Kennedy never forgave him. Even when Frost was on his deathbed in January 1963, the president refused to speak to him. So this speech is also an apology.
If sometimes our great artists have been the most critical of our society, it is because their sensitivity and their concern for justice, which must motivate any true artist, makes him aware that our nation falls short of its highest potential. I see little of more importance to the future of our country and our civilization than full recognition of the place of the artist.
We see how the artist's fidelity has strengthened the fiber of our national life, Kennedy says. It's not empty rhetoric. In a 1962 article about the arts in America for Look magazine, Kennedy wrote that the arts are very close to the center of a nation's purpose. The highest duty of the writer, the composer, the artist, Kennedy says, is to remain true to himself and to let the chips fall where they may. It's a direct reference to Frost.
And the nation which disdains the mission of art invites the fate of Robert Frost's hired man, the fate of having nothing to look backward to with pride and nothing to look forward to with hope.
Kennedy looks forward, he says, to an America which will reward achievement in the arts as we reward achievement in business or statecraft. He lays out a vision for an America respected as much for its civilization as for its strength.
Robert Frost was often skeptical about projects for human improvement. Yet I do not think he would disdain this hope. As he wrote during the uncertain days of the Second War, take human nature altogether, since time began, and it must be a little more in favor of man, say a fraction of 1% at the very least, our hold on the planet wouldn't have so increased. Because of Mr. Frost's life and work, because of the life and work of this college, our hold on this planet has increased.
In unscripted remarks later that day, a humble-sounding Kennedy tells his audience that Robert Frost once said not to let the Harvard in me get too important.
That report on John F. Kennedy's speech about the arts and the poet Robert Frost from WBUR's Kelly Horan. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There is an ongoing battle over net neutrality here in the United States, but let's step away from that for a moment and talk about internet freedom internationally, and not just in China or the Middle East, where internet crackdowns are frequent, but in Europe. Joining us now to discuss is Hiawatha Bray. He writes the Tech Lab column for the Boston Globe. Hiawatha, it's good to have you back.
Yeah, good to be here.
Okay, so you've written about this very interesting case in Austria, and Austria versus Facebook, essentially. What happened there?
Well, basically what happened is that somebody posted some really insulting comments about the leader of the Green Party in Austria. Please don't ask me to pronounce her last name.
Okay.
It's Eva something or other. And what they posted was really rude. In other countries, you have to start with the understanding that we're very much unique in the world with our First Amendment. And even countries that recognize a great scope for freedom of speech are not as open about it as we are in the United States. In many parts of Europe, you can actually even face criminal penalties for saying insulting or racist things to an American. Throwing somebody in jail for being a bigot would seem shocking, but they do that over there. Partly you've got the Nazis and the communists to thank for that. They've had some very bad experiences. So in
Austria,
say
the least, yeah.
Yes, right. So in Austria, when somebody said these really hateful things about this woman, they ordered Facebook to block it. But they didn't just stop there. Facebook already does that in many countries. Like, you can't see Nazi memorabilia if you're using it in France or something like that.
Yeah, because they want to comply with the laws of that country. So what's different
here? Exactly. Austrian court ruled that Facebook had to take it down worldwide, everywhere. They're saying, it obviously, correctly, that if it remains on Facebook's computers, there are always going to be ways for people in Austria to find it. And so they're saying, ultimately, if this is illegal, you've got to take it down everywhere to comply with Austrian law. They're basically trying to say that Facebook has to comply with the laws of Austria, which are in direct contradiction to the whole American tradition of free speech, and would actually reach into the U.S. computers of Facebook and start pulling stuff out.
Yeah.
A similar case has already happened in France in 2015, and Google, in that case it involved Google, they are seeking to appeal. Now that ties into the famous European right to be forgotten. And you know, you can sympathize with that. They're basically like, you committed a crime 30 years ago and you've never done anything wrong. In Europe, you can go and say, please block that so that people can't see when they do a Google search that I once did this particular crime.
Yeah, but Hiawatha, let me just jump in here because
sure.
I don't want to leave the Austrian issue here before we're done with it. Is Facebook complying with the Austrian judge's order?
Well, it's new, and they are planning to appeal it.
Yeah.
They are going to fight it, and for obvious reasons. And I only jumped to France because that case, which happened in 2015, is supposed to be heard this year in a higher French court, where Google is saying, we'll delete this in France, but we're not going to delete it the rest of the world, because you don't have the right to tell us to do that. And the problem is, of course, that a lot of people assume that with the internet being so easy to access and so free, all these old traditional limits on free speech were going to be transcended by technology.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out nothing of the kind is happening. Nothing of the kind. Each country is going and they're going to say, we're going to have our standards of what's allowed to be said here. And instead of us opening them up, they're actually proposing to shut us down. They're saying, we're going to use our laws to force your American internet companies to do things our way. And it's getting pretty creepy.
Well, yeah, I mean, so, as you're saying, obviously this is in violation of some core tenets of what we believe to be free speech laws here
Absolutely.
In the United States. And I hear you saying that Facebook is fighting back, but are there technical solutions to this? I mean, I know the judge is saying that, I guess the judge is saying that he or she doesn't believe that it's good enough that these companies should be able to, I don't know, find out through user data where users are in the world so they can block content selectively. That's not good enough?
Well, that's exactly the problem. there is no perfect technical solution to this because you can always find ways to access this data. The closest you can get is what they do in China. China, for example, has very strict limits. I mean, they control the network of the entire country, and they have cracked down on what is allowed to cross their borders and what is not. It's very difficult in China to say, well, I'll just go to the American version of Google and look things up, because it's blocked in most cases. And there are these things called virtual private networks. Even China has these set up that are allowing people to bypass traditional Chinese censorship. This year, the Chinese government just announced we're cracking down, we're shutting down virtual private networks. We're going to see to it that you can't see anything outside of our internet that we don't want you to see. Now, most countries don't want to go that far. So instead, they're saying we're going to force Google to take it off on their end.
Okay. So, I mean, to be perfectly honest, I don't feel often super sympathetic for giant companies like Facebook and Google. Yeah. But on the other hand, are they between a rock and a hard place here? Because, you know, on the one hand, they don't want judges telling them what they can and can't do with their content. But on the other hand, it's a business. I mean, could this have a negative business impact on Facebook in Europe or Google in Europe?
Absolutely. And in fact, that may be part of why this is happening, because a lot of Europeans very much resent the immense power of the American internet companies, and with some legitimate reason. I mean, Google and Facebook really are dominant in a way that hardly any companies in the world have been dominant in the distribution of information. And a lot of Europeans, not necessarily for reasons of censorship, are really creeped out by that. And they're thinking, you know, these guys have too much power. So that could be part of it. But the problem with that is, if you allow this precedent to be set, what happens when the Chinese come along and say, hey, the Tiananmen Square massacre on Google, that's not allowed in China. You can't do a search and find out information about the Tiananmen Square massacre. They could come and say, all right, we want you to delete it from all your computers worldwide. Can you imagine that?
Yeah.
In theory, they could do something like that, and that would be absolutely intolerable.
But things aren't... Go ahead, Hiawatha. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I was just saying, in my column, I basically say, look, there's no easy answer to this, because each of these countries do have national sovereignty. We can't just say, we're going to ignore whatever you want to do. But on the other hand, we can't let them tell us what we're allowed to do, given our free speech rights. So we're going to have some kind of international convention on this at some point.
Yeah.
It's going to have to be like the Geneva Convention.
Well, let me just ask you a last question sort of on the flip side of all of this.
Yep.
You know, these internet companies, they already tailor the information that we get, right? I mean, they call it customization based on your user data. But on the other hand, like, can't you also see that as a form of censorship? Because Facebook's serving up what it thinks I want, but that may not necessarily be what I want.
Oh, no, that's a very real challenge. And look, that's one of the reasons I say there are no easy answers to this. That's the whole controversy over things like fake news. Who gets to decide what's fake news? Exactly right. There is no simple answer to this, because they have to some extent, control things to deal with actual things like, look at the classic example of people murdering each other now on Facebook.
Yeah.
They have to keep a watch on what people are doing there, and they have to decide where to draw the line. So yes, they're already exercising some measure of control over that. The question is how far we want them to go, and what happens when it's being exercised by the government of another country that we have no say over.
Well, Hiawatha Bray, he writes the Tech Lab column for the Boston Globe, and he always asks the provocative questions. It's always great to talk with you, Hiawatha. Thank you so much.
Hey, it's always fun. Thanks a lot.
Well, here's another question. Is it summer on Cape Cod without a great white shark sighting? We're getting close to that time of year when the great whites make their annual visit to hunt down prey. And the Cape is the only known place in the North Atlantic where great whites regularly gather in large numbers. And according to the latest study by the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries, the number of great white sharks vacationing there appears to be rising. And for towns, that could be a public safety issue, according to the state's top shark expert. And he joins us now in the studio, Greg Skomal. He's the senior scientist at the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have you here in the studio on land.
Yeah, not just on a phone.
So first of all, how many more sharks or great whites are we seeing on the Cape or expect to see?
Well, it's not a simple question to answer, unfortunately. We are in the midst, right in the middle of a five-year population study. So You know, I think another year from now, I'll be able to give you some solid estimates of numbers.
Okay.
But what I can tell you is some of our raw data. And what that means is how many individuals we've tabulated each year for the last couple of years. In 2016, for example, we identified 147 individual white sharks along the eastern shoreline of Cape Cod. The year prior to that, it was 141, and the year prior to that, 2014, it was about 80.
Oh, wow.
So okay. We're seeing that subtle increase from year to year, and as tempted as I am to say that it's actually an increase in the population size, it's more likely a shift in the distribution of sharks in response to the growing seal population.
Ah, that's what I was going to ask you. What's so attractive here about the Cape to sharks? I mean, obviously, there's a lot to attract humans, but so the growing seal population, food, essentially.
Yes, basically, that's it. I think that most people don't realize the interesting history of the seal populations on the northeastern coast of the United States. So they had been all but driven to extinction a couple of hundred years ago. And now with protection that was put in place in the early 1970s, we've seen a slow growth in the population that has now resulted in literally tens of thousands of seals along our coastline. And that has drawn the attention of one of their predators, the white shark.
Yeah. So in a way, this is one of those unintended consequences of successful, you know, federal legislation, for example. But it's remarkable, though. I mean, when I said at the beginning of this conversation that the Cape is the only known place in the North Atlantic where great whites regularly gather in these large numbers, I mean, that's remarkable to you, isn't it?
It is.
It's wonderful to me. So.
Yeah, it's wonderful to me, too, and from a personal and a professional point of view. But it is remarkable. And as a result of the fact that we hadn't had any of these aggregating sites in the Atlantic, we don't know much about this species. You know, certainly we know a lot in other parts of the world and far more than we know here. So this has provided us the first opportunity with predictable access to this species now to study the biology of really arguably one of the most charismatic species on Earth.
So for folks who don't know, your research is possibly some of the coolest stuff that happens in the waters off Massachusetts, because you try to tag these animals too.
Yeah.
And you do. You successfully tag them.
We do. Yeah. We've tagged over 100 now off the coastline there. And it's a bit challenging and exhilarating, very exciting to do. And our objectives there are to look at not only its broad scale movements. Where do they go, you know, in the wintertime? But what's their seasonality around Massachusetts? Where are they in Massachusetts waters? You know, how do they utilize local habitats? And what are the environmental factors that are driving it?
Right.
You know, so a lot of our research is really on what we call the movement ecology of this species.
Now, last summer you tagged, I love this name, Big Poppy. Is that right? A 15-foot male great white?
Yeah, big 15-footer male, and it was appropriate to honor one of Boston's best, and that was named Big Poppy. And we know that Big Poppy went down to Florida, for example, this winter, and we anticipate seeing him again this summer.
Yeah. So describe it to me. Like, if we were on your boat right now, I mean, what's it like how do you get up that close to a great white? I guess you have to get them up to the surface to tag them. Where do you tag them? How do you do it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm one person sitting here, but I'm representing a team of people.
Yeah.
You know, it's a well choreographed and orchestrated process. We have a plane in the air. Wayne Davis is our spotter pilot. He's flying a small plane and he's locating sharks. He's looking for them. Once he finds one, he reports to us on a vessel, and we're a team of about four or five people on the vessel. The captain of the vessel, Captain John King from Chatham, runs us over to close to the shark. And with the guidance of the plane, we get very close. Once the captain sees the shark, he places the vessel right alongside it, and I'm out on the pulpit of the boat, which is the long pointed nose of the vessel, and I'm out there with a tagging pole, as well as a GoPro camera. You know, one of the things we're trying to do is identify individuals. And so when I tell you we identified 147 individuals in 16, that's how we know. We actually videotape each shark. Each shark is unique in its coloration patterns, as well as scarring patterns, and even injuries that it sustained over its life that really differentiate it from other sharks. So we do what I call video fingerprinting, determine who that shark is, and then I'll place a tag in it, use a long tagging pole and a small intramuscular dart that I insert at the base of the dorsal fin. And once that happens, it's very exciting.
Have you ever had any close calls with a great white?
No, I've not. Okay. You know, and I'd like to keep it that way.
How did you get into this line of research specifically?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I grew up in a suburb of New York City, a Connecticut suburb down in on Long Island Sound, and I have to admit, growing up, I didn't spend a lot of time in that body of water. So much of what inspired me to be attracted to the sea and sharks in general was the works that were coming out from folks like Jacques Cousteau at the time. The Undersea Adventures of Jacques Cousteau were out in the 60s and early 70s, and it was really introducing us to the world of being underwater, and that was fascinating to me. So as much as I hate to admit it, it was television. watching Jacques Cousteau and shows like, and well, the movie Jaws, of course, was inspirational to me. Film called Blue Water White Death that came out just before Jaws did, and shows like Flipper, you know, just fascinating to me. And that drove me into really wanting to spend time in the ocean and study its inhabitants, and specifically sharks.
I don't see any problem with you saying that Jacques Cousteau inspired you to want to learn more about the oceans.
Yeah.
Sorry about my scratchy voice today. So here's the question. I'm wondering, with the increasing numbers of great whites that we're seeing coming back to the Cape or the waters off the Cape every summer, I mean, obviously, we want to protect the sharks, but we also want to protect people. And when they come up close to shore, we do keep people off the beaches or out of the water, I should say. I mean, are there concerns that folks have on the Cape? Are there potential, I don't know, long-term business impacts, or just the relationship between what goes on the beaches and what's going on in the water? Is that changing with the growing number of sharks?
Well, I can tell you from a researcher's point of view, as interested as I am in the ecology and the behavior of these animals, their natural history, we're also super interested in collecting the kinds of information about these sharks that will be helpful to beach managers and jurisdictions like the National Park Service, like the local towns. And working closely with a nonprofit called the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, we have formulated a working group where towns sit around a table literally every month or every couple of months to discuss these issues, to share information, to be extremely proactive when it comes to educating the public about the presence of these sharks. We do see them very, very close to swimming beaches, and that's a fact. And we don't bury our heads in the sand when we see these observations. We share them with the public. One of the tools that the Conservancy has developed is an app called Sharktivity.
Yeah.
And Sharktivity is a great way to share information about what we're seeing out there with the public, with beach managers. We send out alerts if there are sharks in proximity to swimming beaches. We really want to be quite open with the public, with the towns, give them the kinds of information that'll perhaps help them better manage their beaches to enhance public safety.
And anyone can get the Sharktivity app, right?
Yeah, it's free. Anyone can get it.
And you can track individual great whites that you've tagged?
Yes. You can track individual white sharks that we've tagged. We can tell you when we see sharks like Big Poppy and where we see them. And what we're finding out is, yeah, there are people who are nervous, but there are also a lot of people out there who are really fascinated. I mean, there are people coming to beaches now that just want to see a shark.
Yeah. So, you know, I should ask you this a couple of minutes ago, but I'm going to loop back to you saying that Jaws was also an inspiration for you, because it's so interesting. That movie, a lot of people point to as one of the main reasons why great whites are so misunderstood, right? Because in that film, you know, the animal's depicted as this dead-eyed, soulless killing machine that's just going to jump on boats and go after people. But here, you've seen it's one of the things that inspired you to want to learn more. I mean, how misunderstood are great whites?
Well, yeah, I mean, Jaws did indeed take some of the worst attributes of all of sharks and exaggerate them to the extent that it was horrifying. And of course, I found it at the time somewhat entertaining. But the character in the book, Matt Hooper, was inspirational to me. Here's a guy that was working in Woods Hole, oceanographic, on the Cape, and studying white sharks. I mean, I thought that was the coolest job in the world.
Yeah.
But you know, sharks continue to be misunderstood, you know, globally. But I think that we've made great progress over the last couple of decades, and social media helps. Media outlets like this help, you know, educating the public about these animals and what we know about them. And the newer technologies that are out there that allow us to track these sharks really help us to engage the public very effectively.
And I think if I remember correctly, I hope I have this right, Peter Benchley, who wrote Jaws, the original book, later said that he regretted, in fact, being one of the causes that of great whites being so misunderstood, and went on to become a great marine environmentalist.
He did, yes.
But I guess one last question for you. There's still so much we don't know about these animals, and human beings have hunted sharks very aggressively. I mean, what are a couple of the big questions you would still like to answer about white sharks?
Well, the questions I have are the same questions perhaps I had when I was an eight-year-old kid. Huh. And that is, you know, How long do they live? How fast do they grow? You know, how many young do they have? Where do they reproduce? Where do they give birth to their young? Those kinds of simple questions. What do they do from day to day, hour to hour, even minute to minute? And the new technologies are allowing us to do that. And perhaps before I retire, we won't answer all these questions, but I'm going to enjoy trying until I do.
Still a mystery. Wow. Well, Greg Skomal is senior scientist with the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries. He'll be speaking tonight at the New England Aquarium's IMAX Theater. His talk is called Seeing Deeper into the World of the Great White Shark. Information about that at radioboston.org. And by the way, we were talking about Jaws. If you want, you can see Jaws in concert with the Boston Pops tonight and tomorrow. They'll be playing the entire John Williams score in sync with the film. Greg Skomal, thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be here.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's take a walk to the place where a man may stand and put all America behind him.
Yeah, we can go down to the beach.
Sure, let's do that. Well, a hat tip to Henry David Thoreau, of course, and his beautiful observation about Cape Cod. Because it was Thoreau's words that bounded through my mind as I walked along Coast Guard Beach in Eastham with writer Robert Finch.
Well, the reason why I wanted to come down to the beach is, of course, the title of your book is The Outer Beach, A Thousand-Mile Walk on Cape Cod's Atlantic Shore. Could we walk in a bit and talk?
Sure. You can't walk 1,000 miles.
No. Maybe half a mile, quarter mile?
Sure.
Okay.
Into the wind.
We walk into the wind. Finch has walked the Outer Beach for more than 50 years, and on this day, it's at high tide. The sky is blue-gray. The water is gray-green, and the surf is kicking up whitecaps, a restless herd of watery wild horses. A nor'easter is on the way.
What about the beach makes it special to you?
Well, that's what all my writing for the last half century has been about. I always compare it to falling in love with someone. You have this passion to know them. You want to find out every possible thing about them that you can. At the same time, you hope you never will, that sense of mystery will remain. And I think that's been the case with me. I was just, initially, I was just fascinated by it, I suppose, in a sensory manner. It's human scale. The whole Cape, to me, has a scale that reminds me of my own humanity. Mm-hmm. On the beach, it's the element of change. Change happens here on a scale that is close to what happens to change in my own life, and I associated with it that way. And that's really what's kept me here, I think. This sense that there's something non-human out there that I find parallels with in my own life, and I try to articulate that.
Can we walk a little bit more?
Sure, of course. The metaphor that most writers use to talk about what's happening out here is war or struggle between land and sea. That's a very human imposed metaphor. And I don't think it really, and I've used it myself. It's just an easy one to come up to. Particularly after a very destructive storm, you just want to compare that landscape to a war site where everything looks freshly destroyed. But it's not. I think if you're going to continue to use human metaphors, it's more of a dance between the ocean and the land. And I think I say somewhere in one of the books that the ocean must, in a way, love the land that it takes because it's given to it so freely, so easily. So I'm going to have to come up with a better word than reclaim, because the ocean never owned it, but it's taking it now.
But you know, it makes sense to me why writers and people just intuitively use, as you said, those very human metaphors.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, for the blink of an eye, in terms of the arc of time that this area has existed in, yeah, we're just occupying the tiniest blink of an eye. But to us, it does seem like there's a constant battle. Even though, I mean, we're the interlopers.
Right, right. Yeah.
Because we're bad. I mean, like, right now, so many of the daily stories coming out of the Cape is people literally battling to save their homes.
Well, that's one of the things that's always fascinated me about the beach. I think what the core of my interest comes from, not just from the natural landscape itself, but how people interact with it and how they respond to what it does. And again, probably one of the more dramatic examples of that is how people respond to erosion. Now, if you're just like us today, a visitor to the beach, this is all very fascinating and beautiful and dramatic to watch this. But if you own a beach cottage or a house on one of these bluffs, and you know that the ocean is going to take your land, surely, with its power of eminent domain, it fascinates me how people respond to that. A lot of people, most people, I would say, who have cottages on the beach or modest houses, accept it. They recognize that their time here on the beach is limited. But there is still this attitude among some people that we ought to be able to beat the ocean. We ought to be able to, you know, be a permanent fixture here and not have to give in to the inevitable. But they're wrong.
You talk about the many lessons you've learned walking these beaches. I mean, has the beach, has the Cape been a teacher to you?
Well, I have one essay in the book where I walk the beach with a friend who's come down from the hills of Vermont, and his life is undergoing some problematic changes, and he's looking for reassurance. And I realize that by living here on the beach, if there's a lesson, the lesson has been how to live with change. Change is inevitable. You have to accept it. You have to adapt to it and rethink your whole position. If you live in a place for a long enough time, it begins to shape your attitudes. It gives you, as I say, those images, those metaphors, those tropes that you can find useful in your own life.
So how have you changed? How has it shaped you?
Oh, my. I suppose as I get older, what the beach says to me more now than it said before is a lesson in mortality. You have to just sort of accept that that's part of the nature. Change is part of the nature of life, and death is part of the nature of life. I don't want to sound too somber about that. And I guess that's one of the paradoxes I find on the beach, too. The beach is inhabited by organisms that are generally extremely fragile. A good example of that being these shorebird nesting areas, especially the tiny piping plovers, which nest right out here on the beach, and very often a storm in the middle of their nesting season will just wipe out the entire colony. And they go right back to nesting again.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're at once fragile and very enduring. And that seems to be innate in the nature of the beast, of the beach, that it harbors conflicting elements. It's constantly creating beauty, and it's constantly destroying it at the same time.
Do you love the beach? Do you love the Cape in the same way that you did when you first came here?
Oh, of course it's changed. Again, the metaphor that always comes to fore is marriage. You know, marriage initially is an experience of possession and discovery. And after a time, it becomes something, well, I was going to say less dramatic, but more deeply satisfying. But I have to be careful about that, because just when I think that the novelty of the beach has worn off, I've seen everything that there is to see, the beach will do something to disprove me of the beach. No, I think I can't imagine living anywhere else, let's put it that way. I've grown, I don't want to use the word comfortable, but I've reached a rapport with the beach that I'm pleased, it pleases me.
To be in conversation with sand and surf for 50 years, honestly, I'm jealous of the soulful rapport Robert Finch has had with the outer beach. Can the young and distracted slow themselves, steady their gaze, and listen deeply enough to fall in love the way Finch did all those years ago? Maybe, the ocean seems to shrug. So I ask Robert Finch to inspire us a bit more. He reads the essay from his book about his first contact with the Cape a half century ago.
The first time I ever saw the outer beach was in the spring of 1962, April, I think, when I was 19. My freshman roommate at Harvard was John Hagenbuckle, whose father ran one of the dozen or so sailing camps that dotted the inner shores of Pleasant Bay in those days. It was not the first time I had seen the ocean. Growing up in urban New Jersey, I went with my family on one or two excursions to Asbury Park, and I have a memory, when I was about five, of standing in the waves, which were as tall as I was then, and of being lifted by them, gently and with a sense of benignity. But we were mostly lake people in the summers, and after our family moved to West Virginia when I was 12, I did not see the ocean again until that spring on Cape Cod, 7 years later. John and I left Cambridge sometime after 11 at night, driving in his old VW Bug. There was a full moon and no other traffic on Route 3 for most of the way down. Somewhere around Plymouth, having seen no other cars for a while, John turned off the headlights, and we drove for several miles by the light of the moon. It was like entering another world. We stayed that night in one of the camp cottages in South Orleans. The next day, a late spring northeaster strafed the land, whipping up a wild surf that assaulted the beach. We drove out to Nauset Beach, buttoned up in the foul weather gear that John had provided, and shouldered our way against the wind and rain out of the parking lot and through a gap in the dunes. When I first beheld that wild beach, it overwhelmed whatever anticipations or expectations I might have had. My reaction totally surprised me and was, at the time, inexplicable. I turned full front to the ocean, raised both my arms, and began to conduct. I waved my arms out and in, up and down, in rough time to the surf's irregular rhythm. Of course, I was conducting nothing. Even then, I felt that the ocean was something that took absolutely no cognizance of me. If anything, it was I who was being conducted by the sea, trying to catch its rhythms and tempi, trying awkwardly to become a part of its overwhelming majesty. Now, at a distance of more than five decades, my reaction seems understandable, even predictable. The only thing in my life thus far that was at all commensurate to what I was experiencing on that beach was symphonic music, mostly the Romantics, Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff, Dvorak, and Sibelius, especially Sibelius. I had spent much of my adolescent years in West Virginia in our family's darkened pine-paneled basement rec room, listening to 33 and a third LPs of those composers on my Motorola portable stereo with detachable speakers. It was my drug of choice in those pre-drug days, my substitute for sex in those pre-sex days. I would often stand in front of the turntable conducting the music in the dark as a way of becoming part of it. It called forth a depth of emotional and psychic response unlike any I had ever experienced or would until that day on the beach. Like the music, but of vastly larger proportions. The storm waves gave me the sense of illimitable power and irresistible force, of lavish, inexhaustible beauty, a mixture of desire and fear, all held within laws, patterns, and a sense of order too vast and complex for my adolescent mind to recognize, let alone understand, but which I nevertheless felt deeply. I stood on the brink of something that could, if I overstepped my bounds, swallow me up instantly, annihilate me utterly, but which, if I showed the proper respect, caution, and patience, might tolerate me, not shut me out, and perhaps eventually might even allow me an audience with his august presence. My awkward attempts at conducting, I can now see, were unconscious and instinctive, an homage, a recognition of a power I had never encountered before, and a desire to somehow be a part of it.
Robert Finch, reading his essay, First Contact. It's part of his new book, The Outer Beach, A Thousand-Mile Walk on Cape Cod's Atlantic Shore. We walked with Robert along Coast Guard Beach in East Ham. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.